Good evening, Deborah Kearney. It's my great pleasure to welcome you tonight to this very special event at Western Michigan University. As briefly as possible, I'd like to just take a moment to thank some of the people who made this evening possible. First and foremost, I must thank David Halperin, who graciously offered to allow us to share in Ann Arbor's good fortune and did all the hard work involved in orchestrating Jamie O'Neill's visit to Michigan. This will be the second of only three stops in Jamie's mini tour of Michigan, which is funded by a grant from the Arcus Foundation and with the support of the University of Michigan's Lesbian Gay Queer Research Initiative and the Institute for Research on Women and Gender. Here at Western, I want to give special thanks to Arnie Johnston, Chair of the English Department, whose enthusiastic support of tonight's event was crucial as we work to fit this late edition into a very busy schedule with the help of Michelle Reska. Very special thanks also due to Chuck Bentley Productions for videotaping tonight's reading. Many individuals and organizations helped us to get the word out, including Bonnie Benson and Tom Myers at WMU, Maren Heinrichs at Kalamazoo College, Sean O'Brien at Notre Dame, Gary Lee McCormick, Between the Lines, the Kalamazoo Gazette, the Western Herald, the Whole Art Theater, and the Kalamazoo Gay and Lesbian Resource Center. We're grateful for all of your efforts. And finally, thanks to all of you in attendance tonight, of course, without whom we wouldn't have an event at all. Thank you for coming out for this rare treat. Now it's my pleasure to introduce to you Professor David Halperin, the W.H. Auden Collegiate Professor of the History and Theory of Sexuality at the University of Michigan. David's provocative and influential work is already familiar, I know, to many of you. Tonight, he will be introducing Jamie O'Neill. Please help me in joining and welcoming him.
Hi, everybody. I'm glad to see you. I'm glad that you're going to help me welcome Jamie O'Neill to Michigan. This is his first visit to Michigan. He had to learn how to pronounce Michigan. He was surprised to discover that he wasn't flying to Chicago. He was up to Ann Arbor. And I think now it's probably fair to say that he has no idea where he is. But in any case, I'm very pleased that he's here in Kalamazoo, especially because, not just because of WMU, but because Kalamazoo is home to the Arcus Foundation, private foundation that supports social justice with special emphasis on LGBTQ issues, and we're very pleased that they helped bring him here. We, of course, would like to see more of you more often in Ann Arbor, but we understand that it's hard to get to, and sometimes it's good if we can bring people from Ann Arbor here, and that's what Arcus has helped us do. Jamie O'Neill is the author of three novels, most recently a book called Bachelor and Two Boys, from which he's going to read, which is, I think, one of the most beloved books in contemporary gay and Irish fiction to have been published recently. It's a book about bravery and heroism, about love and nobility, about dedication to a larger cause, and I actually like it anyway, which tells you what an extraordinary book it is. It is a book that helps us to rethink both Irish identity and gay identity separately and in relation to each other. And it's a book that also does almost grotesque totality. One of the things that many of us, especially here in the United States, expect Irish literature to do, and that is to renew our sense of the possibilities of English prose and to get us to fall in love all over again in English language. So Jamie is going to read from it. You're here to hear him, not me, so I am not going to continue introducing him. I'm just going to hand him over to you. Help me welcome Jamie O'Neill.
Thank you very much. When I get too much praise for my work, I always read out a sentence from the worst review I ever got, and it's from the Jerusalem Post, which is kind of nice anyway, because already there's another continent involved. But it says, a prurient, often voyeuristic, unbearably self-conscious, digressive and tedious agglomeration of pages. I think it kind of deserves an award itself, really, to get so much vituperation into one sentence. Anyway, Between Two Boys is set in Dublin, in Ireland. in 1915, and it follows the year to the Easter Rising of 1916, when for a week a few hundred madcaps, hotheads, fanatics, or brave young men and women, you take your pick on that one, rose in arms against British rule in Ireland. And it was a complete failure. It was a desperate failure. But in a very Irish way, it became something that you would call the triumph of failure. We claim our legitimacy from that moment, and it inspired Ireland to really think of itself differently and to separate itself from the colonial power. In that sense, it had to be at Easter. It was like the crucifixion, then the resurrection. And one of the things that I was trying to do with this is, with this book, was also point out that it's like Wilde, Oscar Wilde, you know, somebody who sunk so low and then rose again to be, you know, virtually supreme as a. I've got to stop talking now and just read. In this first passage, Jim, who's one of the boys of the title, he's gone down the back of the pier, near where he lives, down the back of the pier one dark, stormy night. And there he met a soldier. He had what Joyce would have called an encounter. Now, some days later, he must go to confession. Jim joined the queue of penitents. It was impossible he should say these things to Father Taylor. He had no words for these things. His mind would not consider them, but physically, in a twinge of his head, jarred their notion away. Would Father Taylor know him? The lamp that lit the priest's profile would show his face if the priest turned, if the priest should hunt him out of the confessional. There was a sin against the Holy Ghost that only a priest knew what it was. That sin could not be forgiven. If this were that sin, was there truly such a sin? The queue shuffled its few feet closer to Grace, and he with it. And now he was inside. The confessional evening closed round him, the crucifix glimmered in front. A woman's mutter sounded through the space, forgiven, Latin, click. A moment when all awaits. With a louder click, his own slide opens. Through the cruciform gauze in the grating, the bristling ear of the priest. Jim told his sins that were commonplace and venial, hearing them for a national schoolboy's at his first confession. When he finished, the priest said, "Anything else, my son?" On Jim's hesitating, he prompted, as Jim had known he must, "Sins of impurity." Jim took a breath and, in its exhalation, outspilled the story. All the horrid notes in quavers and breves as he stuttered and paused. How the black bushes he had threaded between and the waves had splattered the pathway. Down the pier till he came to the shelter, and there he had waited while the sea in restless motion moved. On and on, unmanning himself with the awful truths. And in his nervousness and dread, perhaps not entirely coherently, for the priest interrupted and asked, "Was she a married woman?" Jim was startled for a moment, so that he answered, "No." "Was she a fallen woman?" "It wasn't a woman at all," Jim said. The priest paused. "It was a girl, so..." Jim began, but again the priest interrupted. "Had he touched her?" "No, Father. He was certain he had not touched her. Father, it wasn't a girl at all." "Was she a Protestant woman and she did lure him on?" Jim had thought this worst was over, but no, he must suffer the scandal of speaking it again. "Father, he was truly ashamed to tell it, but it was a soldier, Father." "An English soldier?" Jim didn't know. "Was it the English soldier who lured him to the girl?" "It wasn't a girl, Father." With a testy shake of his head that had Jim cowering lest he should turn, Father Taylor gave him to know it didn't matter her age, but it was the sin he should mind. He should thank God and his Holy Mother that she had looked down on him then and prevented his touching the fallen Eve. "Where did this take place?" Jim answered, "The pier." "The pier," the priest told him, was a perilous place. The pier was an occasion only begging for sin. The pier, in fact, was a Protestant intrigue where they paid fallen women to parade in their finery and lure Catholic boys to their peril. Was he sorry for his sin? He was, but there really was no girl involved. It didn't matter was she a girl or a woman, his guilt was the same. But if she was a married woman, then the sin was more grievous yet. Was he sure she was not married? Father, please, it was a soldier. The soldier must look to his own salvation. Father Taylor did not doubt he was a Saxon and a heretic and most like lost to God. Either that or an Ulsterman. However, that he led Jim to the girl did not lighten one jot the blame attached to Jim. Did Jim promise never again to sin that way? It was a heinous sin even to speak to such a girl. Had he spoken? No, Father. Did he promise? He did. Would he promise never again to stray to the pier? He would promise that. How old are you? I'm 16. Father Taylor then, continuing his forcefully whispered mode, discoursed upon chastity and marriage and think what his mother would say and letting down the good name of all Irish boys. With bleak dispassion, Jim listened. The priest spoke of Our Lady and told how every impure thought, how every glance was a thorn in her sacred heart. Jim had had a narrow escape. He might have sinned deplorably had she not been watching over him. Accordingly, he gave penance of rosaries and had already launched into his Latin when Jim touched the grill and he said, Father, what is it? Am I truly absolved? Have you told all your sins? I have, save it was a soldier, Father, not a girl. Will you forget about the soldier? Forget about the girl. Pray for them in all charity by all means. But most important, pray for your own soul that is in peril. And keep clear of the pier, even for fishing. It's actually very difficult up here. I can't see any of you down. You could all have snuck up for a cigarette or a drink for all I know. So it's handy if you do clap. I know you're still here. You know, I gave a reading once in, where was it? It was in Philadelphia. And I'd never, I don't know if you know the big library there. It's like a Gothic building. And I'd never read in such silence before. And it was a Sunday, and it was like everybody had mistaken the library for a church. And I remember I stopped in the middle of a passage, and I said, look, you could at least cough. Anyway, the heart of this novel, It's Swim Two Boys, is the friendship, naturally, of two boys, Jim, whom you've just met, and Doyler. Jim is a shy and reticent schoolboy. I always have problems with that. That's something that's on the back of the paperback, shy, reticent schoolboy. You know, when somebody else describes your work, it never actually seems right. Anyway, he has a notion of a religious vocation, and Doyler, on the other hand, is a rebel. He's a bright boy from a hungry home. In this passage, Doyler takes Jim swimming the first time down at the 40-foot. The 40-foot was then a men-only bathing place on the lip of Dublin Bay. And any of you who've read that other Irish novel by another Jamie, this one of Jamie Joyce, if you know your Ulysses, you'll know that it opens at the 40-foot. It's where Buck Mulligan takes his morning dip in the snot-green, the scrotum-tightening sea. And in a humbler vein, it's where I used to hang out when I played truant from school, because I went to school just down the road from there. Anyway, I'm just going to read now. I'm going to have some water first. Jim stalled in the giddy wind of the point. Get a move on, called Doyler. Slow as a wet week, so you are. Jim laughed out loud. Then he plunged down the steps into the gentleman's bathing place. He certainly did feel giddy. They weren't halfway undressed, and he was laughing again and saying, I suppose they insist on you wearing some manner of a costume here. What's that? Said Doyler. This manner of a place. There'd be rules here and regulations regarding what you might wear and all manner of a thing. Are you right there? Don't you feel it a bit public? You've took a right rare colour. A bit public all the same, wouldn't you say? Doyler skittered and laughed. Jim's towel had unrolled, showing his father's cut-down drawers that Jim wore at the school baths. Put them away, said Doyler, and give us here your hand. My hand? He took Jim's hand and rubbed it between his palms. Stay easy, old chap. There's only the both of us. Didn't I tell you we'd have the place to ourselves? Jim nodded. Doyle's clothes dropped effortlessly in their pile. Weren't you never out for an easy dip? He asked. With a pal, for a lark, like. Lark. Songbird that sings on the high wing, exaltation the collective noun. Jim looked straight in the lakey black eyes. I don't suppose I ever had much of a friend. Like ripples in a sand, Doyle's brow creased. You're a queer one, Jim Mac, I don't mind me saying. Get on out of your shirt and let's get busy. When he pulled up his shirt, there was Doyle's face, tunnelled by the collar. Then the white cloth seeming never ending till its tail slipped over his head. And Doyle's face again, a lopsided grin, appraising him. He'd be all right if Doyle wouldn't be watching the while. You know, you don't look half so scrawny in your pelt. A couple of mornings here and we'll soon have you in sorts. Somewhere in the heat, Jim perceived a smile brought out of him. And don't mind about your lad below. That's only the nerves makes him poke up. Nothing to be shy about. Can you jump in? If I hold my nose. Be sure now it's your nose you hold. On the bold grin, he grabbed Jim's wrist. Steady, go. They raced to the ledge, Doyle letting out his yahoo of a yell. Father, son, the Holy Ghost. Jim lifted, dropped, splattered. A freezer of a sea, punching the breath from out of him. Ears filled with a roaring quiet, falling like in sleep in green and opaque dream. Then the pumping in his ears grew fierce and the lungs were like a paper bag you could bang with a clap. And he fluttered his hands to begin the ascent unintentionally frantically by the end. At last he broke surface and dear joy, there really is air. A hand slaps on his shoulder and up pops Doyle. What cheer, eh? Says he. The weight sent Jim under again and he came up spluttering foam and thrashing. Are you trying to run a foot race or what? That's no way to tread water. Look at here, go slow, be easy. Jim was going to say something, but a wave came and found his mouth. He was coughing and sinking and suddenly an arm had caught him under the shoulders, guided him to the iron ladder up. You sure about this? Honest, I'm grand. The water trickled in and out of Doyle's mouth. He looked uneasy and Jim didn't wish to be the cause of this coddling. See the raft beyond. 50 yards out, a platform was moored. Calm now and slow. Any old stroke, you know. Do you think you can make that? I can try. I'll tell you one thing, said Doyle. You're a plucky devil, I'd say. Plucky? Them times in the school baths, was you ever out of your depth? Once or twice. A wry look. Once, maybe. By mistake, actually. Mary and Joseph, no shortage of guts in this skin, I'm a link. And you after leaping in like it was no bother on you. He would have swum to Hotham back and drowned it twice to bask in such praise. Are we straight so? He asked. Doyle laughed and splashed a hand through a wave. Straight as a rush, he answered. It was actually easier outside of the cove. The waves were against him, but consistently so, rather than bobbing round bewilderingly. His instinct was to exert his strength, pushed to the limit, but he heard Doyle's voice calling, steady on, be easy, and felt his calm, purposeful, foamless form at his side. It was a punisher, all right, and he was knocked up by the time he gripped the looping rope of the raft. But it was grand to look back on the undulant sea and trace the progress of his triumph. Pooped, destroyed. Rest a while, there's no hurry. Doyle climbed on the raft, sending it seesawing up and down, and sat with his arms about his knees. Water spilled from him, tracing the hairs on his legs, puddling onto the planks. On his chest, a medal caught the sunlight as he heaved. Steam rose from his shoulders. Hand up? No, I'm fine. Jim pulled himself up and sat beside, gazing back on the stretch of coast. The mountains swooned with a shadowy blue, but the nearer hills were bracken green and bracken gold. In the vivid air, nowhere seemed farther than an hour's walk. It came to him that the smell he usually took for the sea was actually of the land. Here in the waves, the breeze was clean. They were quiet a while, then Doyle said, odd the way you lived all your life a spit from the sea and you never swam there. Bet you never went fishing neither. And he was off then, telling of the shore, of the conger eel he caught once that near took a chunk of his hand, of going crabbing by Bullock Rocks and settling the crabs to the laddie-das in the villas, of the 2 buckets of mackerel he got once, and how marvellous that was. Didn't he do nothing, only drop the lines and wait a crack? Lashins, I tell you, they was tumbling over themselves, the fishes, to get in inside of the boat. And while he spoke, Jim watched the places he indicated. Kelly Shore, The Creamy Rocks by Bullock Harbour, Mugland Sound with its deeper ominous green where the mackerel shoaled. It awed him that Doyle was not bemeaned by his life as Jim felt bemeaned by his. The lithe and wind-tanned body awed him too, so that he dared only glance at it obliquely, glance and blink, squeezing his eyes. Then Doyle was frowning, concentrating on the shore, the way he was searching for some particular spot. "What you said back there?" he shrugged. Don't suppose I never had much of a friend neither." A long wait, then an arm went round Jim's neck. Again that shock of touch, it near jumped Jim from his skin. It was this way whenever their bodies met, if limping Doyle brushed against him or laughing he squeezed his arm. The touch charged through like a sputtering tramwire until it wasn't Doyle he felt, but what Doyle touched, which was himself. "This is my shoulder, this my leg." And he did not think he had felt himself before, other than in pain or in sin. "Look at the pair of us," said Doyle. "Mother naked on a plank in the sea. Are you straight for your first lesson?" The crawl it is." He was about to slip off, but then he paused. He nodded out to sea. "There's the Muglands out beyond. A couple of weeks back, Easter time, I got to the raft here and I thought to myself, why not? Now there's a stretch would leave you pooped. Destroyed you be with the best of them. The tide sea and the sound gets up a fierce current. Near missed me landing too. Had me scrambling like 60 to gain any go of it. It's all of it rock there. No grass, no nothing. But I found me a dip that was out of the wind where the stone was smooth and mossy. So there I lay in the skin I was born in. Whoever it was had fixed a trough, don't ask me why, that had sweet water when I tasted it. And there's this other stone that rocked with the waves, only slow-like, and let out a moan when the waves went in under. I reckon no one would know that place. But it was handsome to stretch with the moss through me fingers, and I followed the clouds at Tumble Boy. I felt my ease that day. The only company was an old gander, I thought he must be lost, that watched an hour or more, stood in the leg and his nose and his feathers. And do you know what I reckon?" Jim's lips framed a whispering what. "I reckon, if we worked at it hard, every morning, say, we worked on your stroke, before I went to work, before you went to school, out to the raft while the raft is out, every day we'd do it, rain or shine, till you find your feet, or your fins, I should say. I reckon, come Easter next, we'd swim out there together, and I'll show you the place, and you'd know like what I meant." Jim saw the Muglands, little more than a rock to hold the light that told the rock's existence. He saw the green where the current flowed and the crested horse that broke from it. He saw the storms that will come and the dark mornings and the bitter wind out of the north and the east. A year? Could likely do it sooner. That's if you don't turn religious on me. The very idea was cracked. Why would I do that? Doyle laughed and tossed up speck in the sea. "But it wouldn't be the same if it wasn't Easter," said Jim. "Indeed, and it wouldn't. Are we straight so? We're straight as a rush." Doyle spat on his hand and Jim did likewise and the palms rubbed in the smear. "The crawl it is," said Doyle, and he slipped from the raft. Before he joined him and the sea would wash it away, Jim sniffed his wetting palm. A private smell, like leather, bodily, raw. Thank you. Of course, what actually comes at Easter is this rising that I mentioned. And in the meantime, the swim, or the prospect of the swim, has taken on different meanings for the boys as their friendship deepens and as their love grows. At first, of course, it's a boyhood test of endurance or courage, togetherness, whatever you have, that usual sort of thing. Sort of Mark Twain thing, I suppose. And later it becomes a metaphor for Ireland's struggle. And then it becomes a metaphor for the boy's own struggle just to be, to find some place to be. Until in the end, as Jim grows in confidence and awareness of what is happening in his life, he can only explain it this way. "You see," he says, "we're extraordinary people. We must do extraordinary things." And I like the way this boy, who is kind of frightened of his shadow to begin with, he's able to think of something like that, that he's an extraordinary person. I'm going to read something about another character next. And I often describe him as the Holy Ghost of my Trinity. He's an older man called MacMurrough, not that much older. but he's from an ancient Irish family. He's recently, they're rich, in other words. He recently returned from England, where he served 2 years hard labour for gross indecency with a chauffeur mechanic, which is the same prison sentence, of course, that Oscar Wilde served. When we first meet McMurrough, he's a predatory, wounded soul. There are all these voices in his head, and he has entire conversations. He has interior dialogues, let's put it, instead of monologues. And at one time, he prostitutes Doyler. He goes through all that sort of thing. But part of the novel is his coming to terms with himself, coming to an understanding that the goal of our humanity is to be able to love and to be worthy of being loved, which is a phrase out of André Gide, well, to that effect from André Gide. I have to be careful with David Halperin here, because he knows these things off by heart in 10 languages. Anyway, in this passage, McMurrough and his aunt and her priest are driving into Dublin for St. Patrick's Day, and McMurrough is going to pull the priest's leg, presenting Oscar Wilde's trial as the trial of an Irish patriot. And I'm just going to tell you who Sir Edward Carson is, who's mentioned in the text. He was the barrister whose cross-examination of Oscar Wilde began his downfall. And currently, in the present tense of the book, he's the leader of the pro-British faction in Ireland, the Orangists or the Loyalists. It's a happy coincidence that he also used to swim. He was a regular, frequent swimmer at the 40-foot. But he just wasn't a very good swimmer. And you'll find that all these people who are anti-gay and anti-republicanism, and all these, they're all the same people, and they're all rotten swimmers. Anyway, they were speaking of patriots, Dublin associations of famous rebels, of battles ancient and modern. There Lord Edward had lived, there the Danes had fled. On the left now the Ormond camp when Cromwell held the city. The car through sober streets motored, while the travellers made leaps and purlers in time. McMurrough leaned forward from the back seat. We must be coming to Merrion Square. Soon, answered his aunt. Baggot Street, said her priest. Up on the left now. Thomas Devis died there, a pneumonia brought on by ceaseless efforts for young Ireland. A nation once again, that was his. A tremendous port, Madam McMurrough, you will agree. An inspiration to us all, for all he was a heathen. Merrion Square, said Evelyn. I should tell you that Oscar Wilde used to say he was born in Merrion Square. He actually was born around the corner, but Merrion Square is a posh address, so he used to say he was born there. They came into a bosky square of rose and russet terracing. Plates by the doors and close-lipped smiles told guinea fees for doctors, lawyers. Railings curved up steps, unfolding intricate shapes for lantern holding, the snuffing of torches. The sun was seen to attend the upper windows. I don't believe I know, the priest remarked, any patriot associated with Merrion Square, though in course of time our new cathedral will rise here, and what truer monument to our country and her faith could a true-born patriot look for? Wesleyan Ronow and Trinity Fields to their left. The Foreign College, said Father Taylor. A jam of jarvies toward the railway station slowed their pace to a crawl. McMurrough leaned forward again. There was one Irishman associated with Merrion Square, he said. Yes, the English put him on trial. It is ever the way, the priest affirmed. Three trials, in fact. On the first, he had the wit to proclaim, I am the prosecutor in this case. I see, yes, very good, said the priest, for all his country's wrongs. I need hardly tell you, Father Taylor, of the desertion by his friends, of witnesses bullied and corrupted, of the agitation against him got up by the newspapers. It was ever the Saxon sneaking way. Indeed, they say the evening he was arrested, the packet to France was filled to overflowing with like-minded gentlemen, who writes this shite? With like-minded gentlemen fearing for their liberty. Flight of the Earl, said Father Taylor, the wild geese who chose to serve in exile than suffer the alien yoke at home. It is history in a nutshell, but you have not told me this gentleman's name. His conviction was inevitable, but from the dock he gave a celebrated speech which defied to the heavens the traductions of his adversaries. A speech from the dock. I have heard it said and have said it myself. The speech from the dock is the only truly Irish drama. Three patriots may not gather, but a rendition of Emmet or of Tone will edify the occasion. It is a form peculiarly suited to the Irish temperament. And what did the speech from the dock say? The jury was unmoved. The judge called for order, but still the gallery cheered. They may purchase however many juries at whatever cost to their exchequer, but the honest man of the street they cannot touch. But I am surprised I have not guessed the gentleman's name. You must remind me now. Evelyn interrupted. I fear, Father, I may come no closer to the station. Madam, forgive me. I was talking with your nephew. This is fine for me now. Grev mila machagot. Irritating man, she said, when McMurrah had climbed to the front and she was turning the car. He let the boys find their own way into town just so he might have a motor ride. She made for St. Stephen's Green and gave the car at the RIAC garage. They walked to the Shelburne Hotel where she had a day sitting room arranged. McMurrah watched out the window while she sat to repair her toilet. Are you really so lunatic, she inquired, once the maid had left, that you were about to give Oscar Wilde's name to the parish curate? So you heard our little parlance. I'm sure you think yourself most ingenious. Well, said McMurrah, and was he not an Irishman? And did his speech not bring the gallery to its feet? You refer to the eulogium on illicit love. The love, yes, that dare not speak its name. Its name, she said, is buggery, as any soul in the Three Kingdoms might have told him. McMurrah turned from the window, and he looked with smiling admiration on his aunt. Do you know, at home we didn't dare say stomach for fear of my mother reaching for the smelling salts, and here we are discussing buggery and Wilde. You are a breath of air, Aunt Eva. Her lips narrowed, refusing the compliment. She said, the English behaved unforgivably with that man. She saw him in her glass and said, raise your eyebrows all you will, but it is true. They forgot what the continent is for and thought to replace it with Reading Jail. They have attached a cachet to his name, which to this day attracts the idle and dissolute. But then the English have always favoured punishment over sense. The man was a buffoon and ought to have been treated as such, green carnations and all. I don't know that I agree, said McMurrah. Are green carnations so very much more buffoonish than these? He fingered the spray at his breast. These, she answered, are shamrock leaves. They are the emblem of our country, of its holiness and ancientry, which we wear with pride on this day of each year. What is more, admit I have never seen it, but we are told they grow naturally, which cannot be said of a green carnation. Then let us tolderol for nature and deck ourselves in trefoils. She was quiet after this tease, while some emollient she smoothed in her face. Antony, it is a year since you came to me. I did not say then, for you, but you frightened me. Your face was quite stark, and your tongue could be so cruel. I hated to see you brooding and picking over your hurts. Yes, I pressed you into activities. How else to help beyond feeding and lodging you? Perhaps I was wrong. Perhaps it is the 40-foot that has helped you, and I have done nothing at all. If so, I thank the 40-foot. But you have come through. Every day I see it, your old confidence returning. Your face too has cleared and is almost the face I loved so many years ago. You loved? I loved. It was a terrible punishment you suffered. I am not the least deceived. But it is over. You know that it is over. You have come through. Yes, said McMurrah. I think you may be right. I think I really may have come through. You must put aside this fascination with Oscar Wilde. If you cannot forget him, at the least regard the totality of the man. He had a wife, he had children, he worked hard to support them. But for that other buffoon, Queensberry, this would be all we knew of the man, and we should all be very much the better for that. She rose from her seat. Such a pretty green St. Stephen's, she remarked, looking out the window. I cannot think there is call for an umbrella. McMurrah admired her from behind with her beautiful hat that fell in lacy veils, cream and tan and umber about her shoulders. What she needed, he decided, was some poor relative to keep company with her and whom she might quietly terrify. With a start, he realized this was he. She turned. Boots, she said, and McMurrah found the cloth. While he polished, he said, do you remember I mentioned I rescued a man? At the 40-foot, I do. Shall I let you in who it was? Do I know the gentleman? I believe you may. He looked up from his shoe polishing. Sir Edward Carson. The mildest of surprises crossed her face. You are sure? He gave me his card. And McMurrah had not needed his card, for he knew that face well, had studied with perverse fascination the vignettes, the caricatures from the trial. And there he had stood before him, in the 40-foot of all places, with his chewy lips and distended jaw, his slanting eyes and sloped-backed forehead. He stood there, draggled in his drawers, insisting on McMurrah's use of his towel, the brilliant instrument of Oscar Wilde's fall, the classmate who had performed his task, as Wilde had predicted, with all the added bitterness of an old friend, and who since that eminence of the forensic craft, Pelion upon Ossa, had been fomenting orange trouble in his native sod. His aunt said, "It is wrong in me, I know, but I have never looked kindly on the 40-foot. It attracts all conditions, which is always unfortunate. But shall I tell you what I did? You are decided that I wish to hear. I'll tell you, because you may pretend dismay, but I know you'll find it amusing. I kissed him. Sir Edward Carson. Lavishly on the lips. Yes, he had kissed him, clamped his mouth on that awful mug, lips on rubbery lips he pressed, propelling his tongue inside the portals, kissed for all he was worth. And Carson had finally staggered away, spitting and spluttering like all the Irish sea had vomited into his mouth. And McMurrah had laughed like a schoolboy, and he heard now his aunt was laughing too. You are a wicked, wicked boy, she said, and the Lord knows what retribution may come. The Attorney General, King Carson himself. You gave your name? Naturally, I am a gentleman. Oh, quel beau coup pour les Landes! And she gazed upon her nephew with fondest affection. She took both his hands in hers. What a wonderful boy you are, and I did love you so, and I do love you still. Do you think he will make a stink? The man is a cad, and who can say what a cad may do? Let him utter a word, the country shall roar. Now let me look at you. In point of fact, they were not boots McMurrah wore, but stout, toe-capped Oxfords. Putties wrapped infallibly to his knees, cavalry breeches swished as he walked, then rather a plain, disappointing tunic, whose insignia on the sleeve, though he did not understand them, he was reliably informed, proclaimed him a captain of the Irish Volunteers. He even carried his very own swagger stick. "You look most becoming," she pronounced. She settled once again the shamrock at his breast. She angled her elbow. "I shall be proud to walk with my nephew this St. Patrick's Day through Dublin." Right. I've just realised, it's a bit late, but I've just realised I forgot to switch this thing on. Can you hear me? No? I need to speak up. Yeah. I can't hear you, so I'm going to keep on. I'm going to read a bit about Jim's father, who's called Mr. Mac. He's a man of significant face and consequential airs. He was once a quartermaster sergeant in the British Army, and now he runs a corner huckster store. His great wish is to be thought a gentleman, and for his son, Jim, to be seen doing gentlemanly things. And part of the novel is Mr. Max coming to an understanding that beyond respectability and being a dignity in the parish, it's his son and his own great fatherful love for him that's most precious to him in the world. And he's a bumbling sort of fellow, and in this passage he more or less bumps into the Easter Rising. Mr. Mac was a touch light in the head leaving that pub, and considerably lighter in his pocket, having stood treat for some very practical reason that escaped him now, round or was it two for the house? What time was it at all? He came out at a crossroads. King Street said the sign. He stood at the corner. High and low he stared, puzzled to an amplush. He couldn't make it out at all. It seemed to him there were evictions up and down the street, bedsteads coming out and out of the houses, mattresses, said he, even. You'd think all the bailiffs in Ireland had suddenly descended this day, and a rum set of bailiffs that looked too. No more than boys, most of them. Out of every house they came, lugging some old goods or other, and piling them in the street. Children were bawling, women were tugging at their belongings, beseeching all manner of language, dogs abuse, the shrill of their voice, and the piles extending right across the street. Now, that what sense was there in that, only blocking the public highway? Mr. Mack took a step towards them. The street crunched under his boot. Everywhere he looked, broken glass everywhere, bits, bottles, a plate glass smashed. How long was this he was on the skite in the luxury? He didn't know, but there was a riot after taking place in the meantime, and never a constable in sight. A cart was jolting towards the crossroads, and Mr. Mack ran out. Halt, he called. Don't come down. There's glass in the road. She'll slip and hurt the beast. One of the bailiffs stepped out. He had a gun. He had a gun pulled on the carter. This cart is commandeered, he said. Take the gun. Take it off him, a woman shrilled. Shirkers, there's only cowards. Mr. Mack said, what's going on here? The woman turned on him. They took me bed. They took me only bed, they did. The Republic will pay you, missus, said the fellow with the gun. What Republic, said Mr. Mack. Get down off that cart, said the gunman. They took the cart. They turned it endways up with the bedsteads and mattresses. The woman was explaining to Mr. Mack, as a man of some authority and a bowler hat, that it was the bed her mother had left her. Her poor mother, God rest her soul, she died in that bed. The carter's cob whisked its tail. The carter looked round at the circle of people. You saw that, you won't deny it. He had a gun on me. Daylight robbery, said a man at the door of his shop. You lack me up, he had a gun. I'm sweating. Suddenly, down the street came the sound of gunfire. Holy mother of God. Screaming and shoving, the people scattered, Mr. Mack with them, dodging into doorways. Mr. Mack peeked out. Nothing in the road save three girls who stood in a row with their aprons hitched, gaping, and a curious weazen man who hopped about. He had lost a boot, hopped about, bleeding from the glass and dodging bullets at the same time, making an extraordinary stucorn of himself, for there were no bullets to dodge. Nothing at all was happening, and gingerly following the lead of the bolder class of urchin, Mr. Mack came out in the street again. Another crackle of musketry, and they were all scarpering anew, but the fire was sustained now, and clearly from down by the river, way down by the forecourts, Mr. Mack heard. He had received a fierce dig in the ribs, and he was looking about for the culprit, saying, now, now, with his finger raised, when a cry went up, Lancers, the Lancers, the Lancers is coming. Some dashed ahead, only to hurry back, rejoining the mass that generally surged forward, sweeping Mr. Mack along. Now we'll see the fun, said a man in his ear. The Lancers is the boyos will sort them blackguards. But that musketry came from no Lancer's carbine. Mr. Mack recognised that barking discharge, inconceivable though it was in the streets of Dublin. Mausers, without a doubt, great blunderbussy yokes of things the Boers had always favoured. But what would the Boers be doing in Dublin? A hurry of hooves ahead, a screaming avenue formed in the crowd. Terror big in its eyes, a riderless horse bolted through. Up side streets surged the crowd, searching anywhere to centre its alarm. Dumbly, Mr. Mack was carried along. His head, he found, was somewhat obfuscated in drink. He could form no very clear understanding of what was happening, and the natural malignity of streets worked on him so that he had no notion at all where he was in the maze of this back alleys and cuts. Horse clops echoed everywhere, many, many horse, or a few gone galloping wild. The Boer war mausers growled still, and it would scarce surprise him now if De Wet himself appeared at the head of a commando. Wasn't it always whispered De Wet was none but Parnell returned? But who came in the end was only two bewildered troopers. They hunched over their mounts, evidently lost, and the mounts, their reins trailing, snorted and blew. Someone shouted the rebels were at the barricade. And yes, it did look like a barricade, now Mr. Mack came to regard it. The Lancers fired quick cracks off their carbines. There's a child down, someone shouted. Mother of God, we'll all be slaughtered. The barricade returned a broken, blustering volley. Chunks of masonry showered off the walls. The crowd had scattered, losing Mr. Mack his hat. The two horses bucked and tossed, going at a strange diagonal gait, sparks firing off the cobbles, till they reared wildly, bucketed up another side street. A child is down, the call kept going round. Mr. Mack darted out to retrieve his hat, and the crowd, that stupid, poking, gawping mass, heaved behind him again, pushed him down once more to the barricade, breached the rickety thing and fluttered through, tumbling it down behind them. Mr. Mack glimpsed a face, bloodied below, not a child's, thank God, trampled over. A group of men from the barricade, some had green sort of uniforms on them, were advancing with rifles up the farther street. Who are they supposed to be, said Mr. Mack. Them are the Sinn Féiners, said his neighbour. Oh, they're Sinn Féiners, said Mr. Mack, peering the better to see these queer, near-fabled specimens. They'd be thinking to cut the troopers off at the corner. Mr. Mack saw them kneel and ready their aim. He crossed himself. If them fellows knows to shoot at all, them lancers will be slaughtered, said his neighbour. King's men and all. Mother of God, we'll all be slaughtered. Some in the crowd yelled a warning, but no horseman would hope to hear above those cobbles. The troopers came, the rebel guns fired, snarling they fired. The troopers slumped from their saddles, thumped in the road. The people stood stunned. "Murderers," someone called, but the cry was not taken up. Stunned, disbelieving, appalled, and fearful. Slowly the people moved back, separating from the deed doers. A Sinn Féiner lad ran down the road, waving a trooper's lance. In the quiet of the fading hooves, he waved it. He had a flag attached, a queer flag in equal divisions, green, white, and orange. He lodged the lance in a manhole plate in the middle of the street, and there the flag flew, green, white, and orange. "Murderers, murderers," came that voice again, all alone in the quiet. The lad's face flushed with a ferocious courage. He raised his rifle and fired in the air. Only then did his comrades cheer, and they too fired off their guns, that furious joy of blooding. Mr. Mack turned and blundered through the crowd. He blundered by the dead child and the woman who, "Murderers, murderers," wailed. Along the lively, inquisitive streets he lurched. He must find his tram. He must be home. Nelson's pillar fingered from out the housetops. He fixed its direction in his eye, and for once his eye did not deceive his feet. Indeed, a hard push and a scraper would be avoiding O'Connell Street that holiday afternoon. Every tenement, every fever nest, every rookery in Dublin was spilling its contents in the road. And it seemed to Mr. Mack all slumdom must reel its way to his tram stop. Every shawley and shabaroon, every larrikin and scut, every slut, daggletail, trollop and streel, frowsy old bowsies and loitering corner boys, sprawlers and caps, every farthing face and halfpenny boy, every gutty, gouger, louser, glugger, nudger, sharper, sleuther head, every whore's melt of them, Mr. Me friend and go by the wall, the dogs in the street themselves. All rascaldom was making for Mr. Mack's tram stop, and he must pinch and shove to gain any headway at all. At last he stood on the pillar steps, the great, wide, splendid thoroughfare. O'Connell Street was you a Catholic, Sackville Street was you at all in the Protestant way. Was it any wonder if a man went astray in this town? Swarmed with a wild, re-raw, mindless throng. Every now and then the shout would go up, "Troopers," or "The military," or "The police is coming," or "They shooting wild," and the crowd would stampede him by, leaving Mr. Mack to cling to the pedestal as to a cliff to keep any footing. Tricksters was all, hoaxsters, for no police came, no military. Loot was master. By him sailed the most fanciful apparitions. A slum boy in three top hats swinging golf clubs. Dirty-faced girls with boas and high-heeled shoes on. The mess of life veered and shifted. Another plate window crashed. Across the way where the crowd thinned was the general post office. The Sinn Féiners held it. He could see nothing of the Sinn Féiners themselves, bar the muzzles of guns that poked from the windows and crouching forms behind the parapet on the roof. That same strange, unaccountable flag, green, white and orange, flapped above them. What on earth would Sinn Féiners want with a post office? It crossed his mind in a daft way that they, like him before, had mistook it for a bank. Handbills were posted all about, slapdash affairs with shoddy spacing and type. Something in Erse, some further flimflam in English. The Provisional Government of the Irish Republic. To the people of Ireland, signed then by a poweration of names nor he nor anyone else had heard of. The Lancers had charged here too, it was told. There was a dead horse down the way. All about the steps, flowers were strewn and trampled where the flower seller's stalls had been toppled. Barricades blocked the side streets, erected of particular things, bicycles jumbled and piled in one, hunks of marble for another, bales of newsprint, the work of disparate guilds whimsically chosen. Trams had been overturned. There were no trams running, no juice, the tramman told him. Even trains, the Sinn Féiners had dug up the lines. And no polis. No polis anywhere. Withdrawn to barracks. Every last pigeon-hearted, lily-livered, chicken-gutted sneak of them. It was pandemonium. It was Donnybrook Fair. It was all ballyhooly let loose. Naming calls, and he did not dare put words to his fear. But he knew the green uniform Doyle would always be wearing. And he had seen the wish of that Sinn Féiner boy's face. Jim's age, no older. He must get home. Thank you. I don't know if you've got any questions. I'm happy to answer anything you've got to ask. But you don't have to ask any. Should we just go for the wine then? That's what I'd like to do.
Yeah.
Well done.